I invite you to open your Bible to It's super, I feel underwater up here, brothers. I don't know. I don't think I am underwater, but there's something weird with the sound. It's getting better. Whatever you're doing was getting better, not better. Open your Bible to, that's better, thank you. Proverbs 15. And by Proverbs 15, I mean Proverbs 16. So, Proverbs 16. We're back in the book of Proverbs, and I'm eager to be here, partly because I'm eager to finish the book of Proverbs. It's tricky to find my way through, but interesting to me, we landed right back in the middle of Proverbs, literally the direct middle of Proverbs. Proverbs 17, 16, verse 17, is the center of the book of Proverbs. And in Hebraic poetry, that kind of stuff matters. They like to count. They like to measure and balance, and that's how their poetry works. So Proverbs 16, verse 17, is the direct middle of the book of Proverbs, and we've spent a week in Proverbs 16. This will be our second week in Proverbs 16. My ambition was to finish the chapter, but that's not going to happen until next week. So, like we did last week, I want to carefully look at one section of Proverbs 16. We looked at verses 1 through 9 last week, and I'll recap some of that for you, hopefully in a helpful and not overly repetitious way. But I want to look at verses 10 through 15 today, 10 through 15. To set the context, let me read 16 verse 1 all the way through 15, okay? Sorry for all that lead up. Let's jump in. Proverbs 16, 1 through 15. The plans of the heart belong to man, but the answer of the tongue is from the Lord. All the ways of a man are clean in his own sight, but the Lord weighs the motives. Commit your works to the Lord, and your plans will be established. The Lord has made everything for its own purpose, even the wicked for the day of evil. Everyone who is proud in heart is an abomination to the Lord. Assuredly, he will not be unpunished. By loving kindness and truth, iniquity is atoned for, and by the fear of the Lord, when one keeps away from evil. When a man's ways are pleasing to the Lord, he makes even his enemies to be at peace with him. Better is a little with righteousness than great income with injustice. The mind of man plans his way, but the Lord directs his steps. Okay, verses 10 through 15 now. The title of this sermon is Things of Kings. Things of Kings. Let's look at verses 10 through 15. A divine decision is in the lips of the king. His mouth should not err in judgment. A just balance and scales belong to the Lord. All the weights of the bag are his concern. It's an abomination for kings to commit wickedness, for a throne is established on righteousness. Righteous lips are the delight of kings, and he who speaks right is loved. The wrath of a king is as messengers of death, but a wise man will appease it. In the light of a king's face is life, and his favor is like a cloud with the spring rain. This is the very word of the living God. I don't know if you're interested in politics. I don't think I was when I was in college. I had to take a poli-sci class as part of my liberal arts degree, and I enjoyed it. It was the most I'd ever thought about politics or political science or the title of this message, The Things of Kings. I had grown up in New Mexico mostly, and I think I was politically apathetic. I had been taught by my forefathers that the government was something full of bureaucracy. My dad worked for the government, so I think that's maybe why I thought that. And I had just thought that maybe two-thirds of the government was trying to steal from the population, and the other third was figuring out how they could be involved in stealing. So that's kind of a negative view of government, and one that still haunts the crevices of my heart today. But poli-sci helped me think more transcendently about government, not just bureaucracy, but kind of what the nature of governance is. And, you know, in a secular university, it was kind of talking about the origins of human governance and the origins of society from a secular perspective. And it reminded me that there's all kinds of governments, not just the ones that we know in the American political system. In other words, a family is a government. A town or a village is a government. There's all kinds of governances that are all around us. And Proverbs 16 is not alone in the book of Proverbs in addressing kings. Remember, the main audience of Proverbs is sons and daughters. It's to teach wisdom to young people. But the author is Solomon, and his predominant concern was that he would be investing in not just the children of Israel in general, but in his own son, who would be destined to take his throne. And so it makes sense that there's quite a bit of instruction for kings or about kings and rulers and leaders. And my concern is we look at a passage like this and you think, well, I'm not a king. And I'm politically ambivalent or indifferent. And you miss out on how important this is. Maybe you've noticed as people get older, they become increasingly concerned in politics, right? Maybe your parents or your grandparents, they watch the cable news all day long. And perhaps you roll your eyes at them and think, none of this stuff really matters. And I'm not here to convince you that you should take up politics as a hobby. Just because tomorrow's my wife's birthday. And every 4 years I get her a new president. So that's not why I'm digging into this topic. It's something the Bible constantly talks about. And I'm not looking for you to increase your political engagement necessarily, but I am trying to help you build a foundation of wisdom which will, I think, move us on from thinking in an immature way about how believers especially are supposed to relate to the government, how we're supposed to think about those who are in power. Some of you really will have opportunities to speak to and influence people who are in charge. And whether that's the administration of a school or whether that's a local kind of city government or city council or school board, or maybe some of you will work in Washington, D.C. someday, I don't know. But every one of us has a responsibility to think biblically about the role and place of leadership in our society. And it's as giant as the Roman Empire and the Caesars who ruled. And it's as local as a sheriff or a mayor trying to do their job in a small town. And it's as intimate as a mom and dad trying to find out which kid lied in the situation upstairs. Something like that. And so I want us to think carefully about leadership and governance on a most basic level. And I think that Proverbs 16, verses 10 through 15, do a really great job of introducing us to this topic. And so rather than look at the entire chapter, which I'll do next week under the heading of Living Wisely Under a Sovereign God, I want to show you how we got here in this chapter, and then I'd like to drill in a little bit carefully to Proverbs 10 through 15 under the title of Things of Kings, Things of Kings. So, how did we get here? We got here because this isn't our party. Paul Tripp tells a story of, it's a universal story, you could see it anywhere, of a kindergarten birthday party. And there's one bad kid at the birthday party. He is causing a fit because he wants presents, he wants cake, but he's a guest at the birthday party, and he's kind of wrecking stuff because he's consumed with envy and greed and self-centeredness, and he's just being a brat. And eventually, one of the moms grabs the kid's chair and turns it around so he has to look her in the eyes, and she simply tells him, "Johnny, it's not your party. It's not your party." I think there's something true in our minds and how selfish and self-consumed we can be. And we have to start with that reminder that this is not our world. This is God's world. He's the one who made it. And he made it for himself. Specifically, he made it for the Messiah. And it is an inheritance that God gives to his son, all of it. And the world isn't just the physical planet, it's all the inhabitants of the world, all the kingdoms and all the people. Think Psalm 2, the nations rage, the people plot in vain. But God rules over all of it, and he gives it as a footstool to his son. Everything that exists exists for God. It's God's party, not our party. And the basic part of being a believer in God, of being a Christian, is that your life is centered around God and you need his view of things. And maybe the most essential truth about God is what we looked at in verses 1 through 9 last week, which is God is absolutely and meticulously sovereign over everything. And so God isn't a lonely, you know, demigod somewhere in the sky concerned about particular things. God is the God of the universe. He's the only one wise, true God, and he is in control of the entirety of everything in existence because his existence precedes the existence of everything else. And so we start with, this is God's party, this is God's world, this is God's will, and this is God's sovereign reign over everything. And before we can talk about kings and things, we have to talk about the king of all of it. And so verses 1 through 9, which we looked at last week, was my attempt to interpret Solomon, showing us in chapter 16 that there is a relationship between the absolute sovereignty of God that rules and reigns over everything and the 10,000 decisions that you make in a day that all somehow fit under the tension and umbrella of the sovereignty of God. In other words, you make relatively unrestricted choices. You decide if you're going to go to Raisin Cane's or Taco Bell, and there isn't any really forces that are controlling that except your preferences and your appetite and your friends and how much gas you have in your car and 10,000 other things. You're not a puppet. You are deciding what you're going to have for lunch and who you're going to marry and what you're going to do for your job and if you're going to go to class or not. And every one of those decisions is a decision that you make with relative freedom. But every one of those decisions is superseded by and under the auspices of and in the meticulous sovereign control of a totally kingly God. That's why verse 1 says the plans of the heart belong to man. Look at it, 16:1. The plans of the heart belong to man, but the answer of the tongue is from the Lord. Well, that's incredible because it reminds us that the extent of God's sovereignty is without extent. His meticulous sovereignty rules over the many choices of man. And verse 1 tells us that even our plans, which are things that we haven't even acted on yet, our dreams, our ambitions, our maybes, our what about next week or what's going to happen in 5 years, those things that are interior to us, sometimes not even spoken by us, all are underneath the sovereignty of God. He puts our plans, the word is arrangements and thoughts and words, and our verse 2, ways, the path that we walk, and the motive of that path, the reasons why we do what we do, all underneath the meticulous sovereignty of God. Verse 9, the heart of man plans his way, but the Lord establishes his steps. Verse 2, all the ways of a man are pure in his own eyes, but the Lord sifts through the spirits, the unseen motives and beneath the ways and the actions. And so this whole chapter is driving us towards how do we live in a world where God is in control? How do we make choices that are wise? How do we view disasters and evil people who rebel against God and hurt God's people? And how should we live in a sovereign world? And the beginning of the thing is that God is king. And that everything that we plan and think and do needs to be acknowledged by believers is underneath his sovereign plan. And so in verse 3, he tells us, commit your work to the Lord, and your plans will be established. And we start to get some good coaching there on how we're supposed to live. We're not supposed to be paralyzed by the idea of God as some kind of puppet master controlling our every move, and therefore we don't even have a say, and we get this kind of fatalistic mentality that says nothing I do matters, and I might as well do evil, and that kind of thinking is not in the realm of true understanding of the sovereignty of God. Instead, the way we respond to God's absolute sovereignty over our thoughts and plans and words and actions is that we entrust or commit, verse 3, our work to the Lord. And he's the one that will establish our plans. And so it drives us to trust and commitment and prayer. And then we have this statement of God's absolute sovereignty in verse 4 to remind us that everything in this world is underneath his umbrella, his auspices. Verse 4, the Lord has made everything for its purpose, even the wicked for the day of trouble. And so we remember the words of Romans 8:28 that he works all things together for good for those who love God and are called according to his purposes. And every Christian loves that truth because it reminds us that even when our lives are hard or bad or things are going wrong, God is working everything together for our good and for his glory. Or Ephesians 1:11, he is the one who works everything or all things according to the counsel of his will. And so there's not a moment in time or a thought in a head or a bullet in a gun or a lava in a volcano or a dog bite or a circus or anything, circus, that is outside of the sphere of God's sovereignty. The absolute sovereignty of the triune God means Christ is king over everything and all of us, and God made everything for its purpose, even the wicked for the day of trouble. And the wicked most often thinks the opposite of this. Godless people, unbelievers, think they're sovereign. They think they're in control. And at our most sinful, we think that way too. And a good way to describe that kind of thinking is pride. It's pride. Now, you think of pride as just a sin that's ordinary. You think too highly of yourself. And that's true. But when you think about pride in the context of the sovereignty of God, pride is far more insidious than that. And that's why verse 5 says, everyone who's arrogant in heart is an abomination to the Lord. The context is the sovereignty of God. If God is sovereign over everything, a person who thinks that they're in charge of their life or their destiny or their whatever, their little kingdom that they're building, if they think they can do whatever they want to do, there is nothing more offensive to a holy God than little kings who think that they're in charge when he's in charge. James 4:6, God resists the proud, but gives grace to the humble. And repeatedly in the Proverbs, like in verse 5, the Lord detests the proud. God hates pride because it refuses to acknowledge reality. You are not a big deal. You are not in control of this world. You are not the center of the stage. This is not your party. This is God's party. And so God promises that his judgment is sure, second half of verse 5. He will not go unpunished. God is sovereign over those who think they are sovereign. And his judgment is sure and will prove it once and for all. And that should make all of us shudder and go, I'm a sinner. I do think too highly of myself. I am too proud. I want to acknowledge God's sovereignty. Now you're talking like a believer. And how could a believer stand if a perfectly holy God is going to judge every motive and action? And ours are always mixed with sin and wrong. Verse 6 tells us that the way we can stand is only by grace and by the faithfulness of God. Verse 6, by steadfast love and faithfulness, iniquities atoned for, and by the fear of the Lord, one turns away. When a man's ways please the Lord, here's the results. He makes even his enemies to be at peace with him. And so here sinners find grace, and they find truth. They find a God who is willing to forgive and provide atonement and to restore us to relationship with him so that we might live wisely under his sovereign care. And then we come up with stuff like verse 8, better is a little with righteousness than great revenues with injustice. And for the believer, something matters more than riches, more than popularity, more than being thought highly of. What matters more is righteousness, doing what honors God. The heart of the man plans his way, verse 9 says, in such a wise and concluding way, paralleling that first verse, the heart of a man plans his way, but the Lord establishes his steps. What did verses 1 through 9 teach us? That we live and can live wisely and happily and righteously and because of God's grace, under the meticulous sovereignty of God. All our plans can be committed to him. All the motives of our heart can be entrusted to him. Our futures can be the object of our prayers given to God, and we can follow God boldly and faithfully, trusting that he has everything under control. It's beautiful, isn't it? That is how a Christian thinks about the sovereignty of God. But that leads us to verses 10 through 15, the things of kings. Because we all know that there's people more powerful than us. We all have to scratch checks to write for our taxes. We all have to stop at stop signs. And there's no feeling like the lights in your rearview mirror when you get pulled over for going too fast. Our encounter with governance begins with our parents being in charge of us and telling us what to do, and then being in a classroom where a teacher's authority is over us. And then as you have a job and you work for somebody, and as you go to the polls and you vote for somebody, and you experience the effects of little sovereigns that are underneath the big sovereign. And basically Solomon understands this very well because he is one of those little sovereigns. He is a king, and what he does in 10 through 15 is establish the biggest example. If the smallest example is our thoughts and plans, which come and go through our head, and God's sovereign over those, well, how is God sovereign over kings and presidents, dictators and despots, over human lesser authorities? Where does all this come from? If this world is a theonomy, if God is in control of the entire world and universe, if he is king of all, if Jesus is on his throne ruling and reigning, well, where did these littler kings come from? Good ones and bad ones, friendly mayors and nasty despots. How do they fit into this sovereignty? And verse 10 through 15, I think, gives us some good instruction on the things of kings. So work with me in verse 10. It says this, an oracle, that's a divine speech. It's sort of like the word prophecy or, you know, a word from heaven. It's what prophets spoke. An oracle is on the lips of a king. His mouth does not sin in judgment. What verse 10 is introducing us to is deep and basic political theology. And it's simply telling us this. Yes, God is sovereign, verses 1 through 9. He is king. He is in control. But that doesn't mean you get to run around going, nobody's the boss of me but God. I don't have to listen to my teachers. I don't have to pull over for the cops. I don't have to acknowledge any presidents that I don't agree with. God is my king. Wrong. God invented human governance, and he authorizes every king, good and bad, and puts them where they are in the sphere of their sovereignty. And it's a remarkable thing because that's what affects our lives. There are countless unbelievers who do not acknowledge the sovereignty of God, but they're well aware of the politicians they disagree with or the policies that cramp their style. And what they're failing to acknowledge is authority structures are everywhere. And the source of every authority, the source of every king is God himself. So much so that Solomon reminds us that when a king speaks, he is speaking in one sense on behalf of God. When a ruler rules, he is representing God. That's incredible. It's basic and it's primary and it's how God built the world. First point. First point just now, weird. One. God designed government. You could jot it down if you want. God designed government. And I could show it to you in Genesis chapter 9, just real fast. Real fast if I could find Genesis chapter 9. Genesis 9, verse 5. God puts a rainbow in the sky for Noah to remind him of how he will never flood the earth again. And as he gives Noah instructions for what the world will look like after the flood, he says in verse 5, "And surely I will require your lifeblood. From every beast I will require it, and from every man's brother, I will require the life of man. Whoever sheds man's blood, by man his blood shall be shed. For in the image of God he made man. And as for you, be fruitful and multiply. Populate the earth abundantly and multiply in it." Here is the basis for human governance. And there's literally only 8 people on earth. Noah and his grown kids. Mrs. Noah, his grown kids and their wives. That's it. And God establishes governorship through Noah and then through the spread of the whole earth that people should fill the earth and that they should abide by this principle at least and at first. If you kill someone, if you murder someone and their blood is spilled, then your blood should be spilled. It sounds to our modern age barbaric, doesn't it? It's called capital punishment. And, you know, your junior year of high school, you on your debate team, you had somebody had the pro, somebody had the con, and you thought it was kind of up for discussion. But guess what? Not in God's world. In God's world, capital punishment is the most basic framework of human governance. In other words, it was God's job to give life. It was humanity's job to protect life. And there's some kind of barriers put in place to help people understand, like if you kill somebody, it's going to cost you your life. And that has been the basis of tribes and villages, of tiny countries and big countries, of monarchies and of democracies for as long as human governance has existed. Today, people question the wisdom or the morality of capital punishment, but God doesn't. He simply tells us that if you take a life, your life is required. And maybe you don't like that. Maybe that sounds disagreeable to your modern senses and proclivities. Tough. It's not your party. This is how the world works. In this most basic sense, God establishes a rule to protect humanity, which we'll find out is the purpose of government. Verse 10 says that the king represents God and oracles on his lips. His mouth does not sin in judgment. In other words, it's the king's job to uphold basic and primary justice. If you continue to study the Bible and how God ruled over his people and how he gave leaders and laws to his people in the old covenant in Israel, you'll find this extends to other things as well, like the right of property. There's things that belong to you. And there's things that God required of his people, that part of what belonged to them belonged to him in the offering systems. Part of what they had, they were to give to temple worship. Part of what they had was to provide for the poor in their society. And so you could take this beyond just the issue of capital punishment and look at property laws or look at the protection of other rights or what happens if a pregnant lady is struck and her baby dies and how that should be dealt with. And so God provided all these laws for his people as he ruled over Israel as a reminder that there are all kinds of things that kings rule into. And when he makes his judgments on behalf of God. The role of a king, God's designed government, is that justice is a blessing. Point two, justice is a blessing. Verse 11, a just balance and scales are Yahweh's, and the weights in the bag are his work. God desires for human governance to exist. And again, you could be talking about mom and dad or the mayor or some dude with a crown on his head in a village in the middle of nowhere. And what we're talking about is what God made authority structure for. And the first thing he made it is to represent his interests in justice. And the second thing is that he's showing us that this is a blessing because where rulers are, there's supposed to be integrity. Integrity. And so he talks about a just balance and scales. It's how they would carry around economics. In other words, I'm going to sell you this bag of grain and it's worth 2 lambs. Super fancy non-GMO grain. And you have to weigh my grain and make sure it's the equivalent of however many stones I said it was. And so you weigh it out and make sure nobody's getting cheated. You make sure that the gold isn't fake gold. You make sure that the lamb is healthy and it can be bred or bread, like make more lambs, not lamb bread. That's could be delicious, though, actually, lamb bread. But all of that is just an example of weights and measures. And the Proverbs continually talk about the fairness of weights, the fairness of measures. This is something that still happens in governance today. There's a guy that goes to our church. We'll call him Thomas, because his name is Thomas. And he worked for the city, and he would go to Target. I think I've told you this story before, maybe even Proverbs. And he would fill his shopping basket with all kinds of stuff at Target. Doop, 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 doop. And he would write down what the price was on the shelf in his little notebook. And then he would go to the cash register person, you know, some kid with purple hair and a red shirt. It's Target. And say, I'm from the weights and measures department, and show his badge. And they're like, I'll get the manager. And the manager would come, and they know about this guy because this is what they have him all over the city. And he would make you ring up his whole basket of stuff. Bleep, bleep. And as you did it, he would have you print a receipt, and he would compare it to what the price was on the shelf. Wait, the shelf said $13.99. You just charged me $15.99. You're under arrest. Weights and I made that part up about the gun. But it was the weights and measures department. What are they doing? They're trying to protect consumers. They're trying to make sure that there's no false scales. This is how the world works. We're trying to make sure that the citizenry is not getting exploited and cheated. And this honors God. So justice is a blessing. Point three, kings can go bad. Kings can go bad. Verse 12, it's an abomination to kings to do evil, for the throne is established by righteousness. Now, I could show a central church here. There's a lot of options. I gotta do work. But let me help you think of an adequate, let me show you an inadequate way of thinking about bad kings. Historically, Catholics have believed that the Christian position on government, as outlined in Romans 13, flip over there for me really fast. We're doing work today. Romans 13. Everyone must submit himself to the governing authorities, verse 1. For there is no authority except that which God has established. The authorities that exist have been established by God. Consequently, he who rebels against the authority is rebelling against what God has instituted. And those who do will bring judgment on themselves. Okay, that's two verses of Romans 13. He carries on and he has two imperatives, one about obedience, one about paying taxes to commands. Romans 13 is reminding us of the responsibility of kings, of rulers, of leaders, is to protect the people and to uphold righteousness. And the bad way or the inadequate way of thinking about a Christian's relationship to government, basically held by the Lutherans and the Roman Catholics for centuries, has been to say, you always obey the government unless they tell you to sin. Now, that's true. You should always obey the government, and you shouldn't obey the government when they tell you to sin. But that little sentence is way too inadequate because it doesn't take into account what kings are for according to God. That God does not approve of a king when he does things that are opposed to God. In other words, there is a more careful and thoughtful way to think about a Christian's relationship to government than I just obey everything the government says, blindly following all edicts and orders, unless they tell me you should steal, you should murder, then I have to disobey the government because those are clear commands. The problem is that that's a bad definition of sin, and it's an inadequate understanding of what the government is for, and it isn't reflective of Christian political theology throughout the centuries. There's a lot to do here, but I'm going to try to keep it on the level of helpfulness. Verse 12, Proverbs, it's an abomination to kings to do evil, for the throne is established by righteousness. In other words, the existence of the king is good, and it's evidence that we have God. He cares for us. He provides for us. And where some are saying the government has to be obeyed unless it compels you to sin, that gives the government far more power, in fact, the same amount of power that we would give only to God. Because government is flawed and sinful and can turn evil, and God's governance does not. Jesse Johnson, in his book, City of God, City of Man, fellow Lobo, opens with an illustration somewhere in the first chapter about the government telling its citizenry, because of environmental laws, and these are real environmental findings. Some environmentalists have said that your car should be white, that you should have a white car, because white deflects heat, and it will use less energy to cool your car, and therefore less carbon footprint, whatever that is, when you have a white car. And so, some environmentalists, just so you know, disagree with that because they say that makes the heat reflect and can cause the environment the opposite problem. Anyway, it's debated. But Jesse says, for example, the government tells you you have to drive a white car. How are you supposed to respond to that? The Catholic view is Christians can't say, hey, that's not a sin. Driving a white car is not a sin. Having to paint my car is not a sin. Is there any room there for civil disobedience? Can a Christian ever disagree with the government and make a decision that says, you're not allowed to talk to me about what kind of car I drive? Well, that enters into the realm of Christian conscience and freedom. And now that's a silly example because it's about a white car, but every example could be called silly to some degree, because they could also, that same government could say to you, we really need child literacy rates increasing. We're not happy with how this is going in the population, and therefore, you need to send all your kids to us for 5 years. They need to live in government homes and be raised by government proxies for 5 years. Well, the moms feel really nervous about that, and they feel differently. Like, I'll drive a white car, but I'm not going to do that. What this is starting to come down to is the government needs to be evaluated on standards according to God. Their job is righteousness, and their sphere is limited. And so put that as number three, was kings can do bad stuff, right? Or something like that. Put number four is kings are limited in their sphere. Kings are limited in their sphere. So how is this biblical? Well, it's biblical because in Romans 13, it tells us that kings are always related to God in what they are commanding and what they are able to do. They bear the sword. In other words, they have the ability to punish us and to hurt us. And there's lots of examples of when kings do bad and when God's people disobey them. For example, the Hebrew midwives were commanded to kill all the Hebrew babies in Egypt, and they disobeyed the government. Well, that was an example of being commanded to do something that's sinful. Rahab disobeyed her king when she hid the spies. Saul in 1 Samuel made a crazy edict where he said, no soldiers can eat until we've won this particular battle. And his son, Jonathan, says, that's a crazy rule. My dad's off the rails. I'm going to eat. Saul responds by saying, I'm going to kill Jonathan, my own son. And the entire army goes, no, you're not. We're going to protect him. This is crazy. And so things can get more complicated than just, well, we always obey the government. Even to say that is a crazy thing for a Christian to say. The only thing you should say we always obey is we always obey God. We always obey God. He's the only one we can say always to. In fact, as the apostles encounter the resistance of evil governments against the Christian faith, they said exactly this in Acts 5:29, we must obey God rather than men. And in the future, the Antichrist in Revelation 13 will command the entire human population to worship him. No Christian can say, well, you know, I think I'll just compromise on this one small thing. The basic reality is not covered by, well, unless it's sin, I can't do it. That's inadequate because of the role and place of the government. God put government in spheres. And instead of thinking like a Venn diagram, you know, the circles that overlap a little bit, I want you to think of one giant circle. And that is the sphere of Christ. Everything is under the authority of Christ. And so there's limitations. And Reformed Christians have traditionally, the Puritans especially, have thought more carefully about how we react and relate to government. They think of spheres of governance, family government, civil government, and church government, all of them in the bigger circle of Christ, all of them overlapping in some ways, but sovereign in their own spheres, so that a family has its own sphere of authority, so that the civil government has its own sphere of authority, so that the church has its own sphere of authority. And in each society, these things may overlap in different ways, but they always are separate spheres. This is why our church got in the what we call the hot water over the COVID stuff. And it's why so many Christians had a hard time figuring out how to relate to that. Because so many Christians said, the government isn't telling us that we can't worship Jesus. They're just telling us we can't meet. That became a conflict according to the spheres. And as it got more and more clear, well, you can meet, you just can't meet at your church. You can meet, you just can't serve communion. You can meet, You just can't cough on each other. You can meet, but not in groups larger than 15. You can meet, but you have to follow these sticky lines we put on the ground. Things got weirder and weirder because someone was going outside of their sphere of authority. And I get that there's building codes, and I get that there's a fire marshal, but there's also a Christ on his throne, and ultimately pastors and elders have to answer to him before they answer to the mayor or to the governor or to the president or to a dictator. Charles Hodge says it this way: an unconstitutional law or commandment is a nullity. No man sins in disregarding it. He does so, however, at his peril. In other words, I'm giving you this speech that normally Christians are just going to obey and submit to the government because the government just wants some of your money. At some point, if you choose to disobey the government because of your Christian conscience, because of a sphere of authority, because of what they're saying for you to do with your kids, you will not necessarily be in disobedience to God, but you will receive penalties for that. And that's part of the right of the government to do that. All right, so that was kind of a lot. I'm not sure how crystal clear it was. I could almost pause for a Q&A right now, but I don't think I will. Instead, I'm going to keep going. Everybody take a breath. We got three more verses. We got this. Verse 13. Righteous lips are a delight of a king, and he loves him who speaks what's right. Here's where something is smarter than government officials. Something is more on base than government officials. You know what it is? Truth. Truth matters greatly to the way God has administrated this world. And that's why we need to be very careful about accepting everything that you hear from a so-called authority who's telling you exactly how you have to live your life, because you do have an obligation to say, what is true here? What's actually accurate here? And Acts 5:29 comes into that when the apostles say, we must obey God rather than men, because they were compelled to preach. And the authority said, look, here's the thing. You could preach, just preach in the synagogue, just preach in your little meetings. You can't do that out in these streets. Well, the streets are only partly under the authority of Rome. They're mainly under the authority of God. And God commands us to preach the gospel, and the apostles could have very well gone, well, let's modify our evangelistic techniques so we can be simpatico with the government. But that's not what they said. They said, we must obey God, not man, and they went to jail. Both. And so, in God's design for government, government is supposed to do what's right and righteous and good and producing integrity and promoting the protection of life and freedoms for its citizenry. But government goes bad, and so Solomon's warning himself, his sons, all governors who will follow him, that righteous lips are the delight of a king, and he loves him who speaks what's right. Governance must be executed on the basis of what is actually true. Verse 14. That's point 9, truth matters. I have no idea what point I'm on. Verse 14. A king's wrath is a messenger of death, and a wise man will appease it. All right, this is point 6. Massage. Massage, it's called. Weird point name. Do you understand that all governance, all politics, whether it's in a classroom or a family, have consequences and opportunities for wiggle room? And this is where I'm just blown away by the wisdom of the Proverbs. The king has the right to kill you. You can argue with him, but he has dudes with swords that could lop your head off. And rather than saying, well, do whatever the king says, worship idols, paint your car white, do whatever the king says. Instead it says, and this is so Proverbs, a wise man will appease it. And now we're thinking of all these examples of judges who wisely in serpentine ways figured out how to navigate politics for the glory of God. We think of Nehemiah appealing to the Persian rulers to get the temple built and to be let go of his present responsibilities to go do that. How is he doing it? He's doing it with wisdom, with persuasive words. He's appeasing his way through it. This is the equivalent of working within the government. This is all the movements from lobbying to petitioning to arguing to city counseling. I mean, you can speak up on the basis of wisdom, on the basis of society, and you can argue with those who think that the right to kill a baby in the womb is something that needs to be protected. And a wise man will go toe-to-toe, even at the threat of death or at the threat of imprisonment, in order to appease or navigate the difficult arrangements of authority under the sphere of God's sovereignty. Verse 15, in the light of a king's face, there is life, and his favor is like clouds that bring spring rain. Okay, I know I'm talking to a mainly American audience in here, minus the Moffats, and they'll give up their pocket knives so fast. Just right, give them right up. But when I'm talking to mainly American office, I'm also talking to people who are, one, rebels because of their sinful hearts, and rebels by creed, like 1776, yo. And so we love the idea of civil disobedience kind of naturally to us. And I love how the Proverbs doesn't let us go, well, I'll obey everything that the government says, or I'm going to fight the government nonstop. Instead, it's telling you, what if you navigated trying to seek the king's favor, trying to seek approval? And this seems to be where the Bible lands in how you actually act out on all this stuff. Some of that, well, I don't know how jumbled it was political theology. Here's how it actually works out. So you're saying, what do I do? Here's what you do, 1 Timothy 2, 1 to 2. First of all, then, I urge that entreaties and prayers, petitions, and thanksgivings be made on behalf of all men, for kings and for those who are in authority, so that we may lead a tranquil and quiet life in all godliness and dignity. And so now the Christian's fundamental takeaway position is so proverbial. They are navigating the wrath of a king who can kill them or imprison them. They are entreating and trying to graciously engage the king because of his power and because of the blessing that can come from that. And so here you have the wisdom of negotiations and the wisdom of grace and the posture of thankfulness and awareness that even the worst governor, there are some things that he does right. And you may make more progress politically and Christianly if you would acknowledge that helpful balance rather than just throw a bottle of flaming stuff at the government building. And so it leaves us in a position of submission and wise consideration, of appropriate engagement, but ultimately prayer and thankfulness on behalf of kings, because kings need Jesus too. Kings need to be converted too. And our primary concern is not political engagement. It is not proving the government wrong. It's mainly this. We want to lead quiet lives in godliness and dignity. 1 Timothy 2, 1 to 2. How do I wrap it all up? Only God knows. But let me tell you a story. The story is from a missionary book called Warriors of Ethiopia on my shelf in the office. The author's name is McLellan. And he tells a story of 42 evangelists from the Walatia tribe in Ethiopia. And it was their desire, they had been converted to Christianity, to take the gospel to other tribes in their region. So these men, these 42 evangelists, packed up all their stuff, all their families, and moved across the country to this Gopher region. They rented land, they built houses, they planted their crops, they met their neighbors because they felt compelled that they needed to bring the gospel to this place. And as they did, as they established their lives there, as they lived their godly lives among their new neighbors, some of their neighbors were converted to Christ. They built a church where they fellowshipped and worshiped. But too many changes were taking place. It was too much Christianity at once, and it was affecting the economy. There was so many people that came to Christ that the witch doctors in that region no longer were making money. The priests in the country was Orthodox, were no longer getting the same amount of tithes now that these people were worshiping in the purity of the gospel in these simple churches. And so the taxes were being affected. And because the taxes were being affected, the policemen were not getting their bribes anymore. And so they'd had enough of this new evangelistic gospel Christianity in Gopha. And so a police lieutenant arrested one of the main evangelists, a man by the name of Otero. He chained his wrists together and clamped down his ankles in iron shackles so that he could no longer walk around and preach. He could only hop. And he pushed this evangelist out in front of a crowded market on market day. And he made an announcement that this is what would happen to anyone who follows the new religion. And he commanded Otero to go back to Wolaita and take your Jesus thing with you. We don't want your Jesus here. Government. Otero hops forward and says, "Oh, sir, listen. Please listen. I can go, but the gospel will stay. By the power of God, I planted Jesus in Gopher. He is planted in the hearts and souls of the Gopher people. I can go, but Jesus will stay." Look outside of all the spheres we talked about and remember this, that nothing can stop Jesus's kingdom. No authority, no power, no rebellion. That there is a kingdom that we are a part of, if you're a believer, that is invincible and unstoppable. And though kings and lieutenants and police and governors and senators come and go, there is a ruler who is our ruler, who is not just ultimate, but total in his sovereign sphere, that we'll obey, and what he accomplishes will never be defeated. As we align our lives to the God who rules this universe, we live among lesser rulers with wisdom and grace and truth and gratitude and prayerfulness, and we trust the God who is sovereign over all of it. Father, thank you for your word today. Help bring this to a point of clarity for these students. Such a huge topic to think about, something that's deep and rich and complicated, but ultimately help them sift through what's most helpful, most clear, most biblical. Help us to follow Jesus with all our hearts, knowing that he is our king. Help us to navigate every other kingdom according to that ultimate authority. And we thank you for our rulers and our governors, our mayor, the crooked ones and the straight ones, And we ask that you would save them. We ask that you would help us to know how and when to submit to them and how and when to defy them when we obey King Jesus. So, Father, thank you for this reminder from your word. Fill it out as we study your truth. In Jesus' name, amen.